We're talking about artificial intelligence, AI, here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The COVID-19 pandemic has disrupted every industry. We humans have learned to socially isolate, to mask up, to develop all of these workarounds to the upheaval. What can machine learning do to help solve this global health crisis? Smart products perform tasks that typically require human intelligence, but even the most advanced machine learning can only be as good as the data sets they're trained on. And in recent years, algorithmic discrimination and data sets replicating racist outcomes and their results that have plagued would-be advancements. So how far-reaching is AI and what concerns you? We're at 800-642-1234. Matthew Friedel is a senior lecturer in UW-Milwaukee School of Information Studies. He co-founded the Disruptive Technologies Lab. Matthew, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you, Kate, so much for having me on.
So artificial intelligence is all around us. Sometimes we're aware of it, sometimes we're not. Can you explain where it's showing up most in our world?
Yeah, there's probably some areas that our people are familiar with and probably some areas they're not. Obviously, self-driving autonomous vehicles is one. Tesla is an example of that. Content recommendation systems, you know, on a daily basis, your Facebook feed or your Instagram feed is tailored specifically towards you. When you log into HBO or Netflix, you know, you get recommendations in terms of movies. The algorithms behind the scenes are based off of artificial intelligence. And then, you know, another area is image and video processing. So I'm a member of Global Entry, so that allows me to bypass customs sometimes. And if you've ever uploaded an image onto a social media and then been auto-tagged in that, that's AI behind the scenes. So these are kind of technologies that are happening behind the scenes and people may or may not be familiar with it.
Can you explain the difference then between AI and machine learning?
Yeah, so if you think about like the taxonomy of AI, it's a bigger circle. Within that circle is machine learning. And machine learning essentially is just the ability for systems to automatically learn and improve from experiences. So we're feeding it images, or we're feeding it text, or we're feeding it data, and then it's learning off of those data sets or those experiences.
And these data sets can be mammoth. Is that right? And they can pull from anywhere.
They're huge, yes. And then the more data, the better that the systems can learn. So think about your own experiences. And there's a couple different sources you can get it from. There's proprietary sources like manufacturing floors, or customer data. And then there's open sources, you know, like social media posts, or government collects a significant amount of data in a variety of different ways. So they're all used in AI and machine learning.
Well, you know, some researchers have been concerned about the lack of transparency of these data sets, that software is often proprietary, which means there's intellectual property involved and copyright protection. What concerns you there about access to these data sets and where this information is coming from?
I think it's a real concern. It's a real concern. So companies, especially the tech companies, are collecting significant amounts of data about us and about our behaviors. And what was interesting about it is UWM brought in Sabila Balikum, a Harvard fellow from the Beck Klein Center for Internet and Society, to talk about this very topic because people have concerns about how their data is being used. And for the most part, it's being used, you know, to offer you real, legitimate products and services. So you go into Netflix, you want, you know, a documentary that's going to be in line with what you're looking for. But there's also been situations where there's been, you know, malicious circumstances where Cambridge Analytica obviously is a use case in that circumstance. So I think it's going to require a couple things. It's going to require social scientists on these teams in order to be able to evaluate whether the programs and projects that they're putting together are ethical. So it's not going to be just technical people. It's going to be people with political science backgrounds, sociology backgrounds in order to evaluate these things. And then on the United States side, I would like to see regulations. So Europe has the General Data Protection Regulation, and there's three pillars that are associated with that: the right to access, the right to explain, and then the right to forget about the data that these companies are collecting. So I think it's going to require stewardship in terms of the efficacy of our programs, and then also maybe some government regulation in that circumstance.
We're talking with Matthew Friedel, who is a senior lecturer with UW-Milwaukee's School of Information Studies. We're talking about AI, artificial intelligence, the advancements, the shortcomings, and where we're headed with it. How often do you use artificial intelligence apps in your daily life? Do you ever wonder how websites like Facebook decide what ads to put in front of you? Are you in data science, and what is your work in AI? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Matthew, racial bias in AI technologies is a really serious problem because, you know, machine learning uses algorithms. These algorithms are our opinions written into code. And so you get this massive amount of data with organizing it and then predicting outputs. Those algorithms may latch on to, implicit bias or the wrong data. How do you explain machine learning and AI in the facet of racial bias?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So the bias really comes in not so much in the algorithms, which are rooted in statistics, but in the data themselves. So if you are feeding, let's give an analogy. If you're feeding a program pictures of cats and dogs, it's not going to know what a mouse is. So your bias is going to come in what you're feeding it. So if you have a collection of data that's only from one customer segment, you're missing one, an opportunity, and then two, you're adding bias in. So I think the solution to that has to be, you know, a very big picture look at all the data sets and whether it's really capturing all of your customers. So the bias occurs not so much in the algorithms as it does in the data that you're feeding it into those systems that are hopefully going to, you know, gain some knowledge out of that data.
How can we actively prevent implicit bias from infecting our technologies?
I think it takes, a social science approach to be able to do this and an evaluation on whether this is really ethical and whether it's really capturing all of our customers and whether we're really meeting those, you know, particular their needs and their pain points or not.
There's also this diversity crisis in AI. A report last year by the AI Now Institute at NYU found that more than 80% of AI professors are men, and that in major tech companies, the study found women comprise only 15% of AI research staff at Facebook, 10% at Google. How can these robotic tools be successful when there is not parity at the table in creating them?
I think that's a valid question. And again, at UWM, what we did is we brought in, you know, somebody who specializes in this area to educate our faculty and staff on diversity. And there are initiatives on the forefront, especially to bring AI and education to areas that have normally not been had access to that. And I think we're only going to be successful by educating not a select few, but by many, many in this area.
We're talking about artificial intelligence with Matthew Friedel of UW-Milwaukee School of Information Studies. The growing use of AI has given rise to legal, ethical, and regulatory issues. How is AI affecting your work or your industry? Will artificial intelligence one day make your job obsolete? Do you think about AI as you interact with smart appliances, your smart speaker, how you decide which shows and movies to watch? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Matthew Friedel here on the Ideas Network. You're with us in the morning show as we talk about AI, artificial intelligence, and the future of machine learning. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. AI gives us driving directions, music, movie recommendations. It comes in the form of chatbots, these computer algorithms able to simulate a human conversation and answer questions to personalize any experience from shopping to coronavirus system triage. Who do you think should govern the technology advancements like AI? Do you want a robot that can help you make decisions? Where do robots not measure up to humans? It's 800-642-1234. Matthew Friedel is a technology instructor at UW-Milwaukee and an investor with Silicon Pastures Angel Investment Network in Wauwatosa. He stays with us. So, Matthew, let's look at COVID-19 right now. How is artificial intelligence helping us in battling against the coronavirus?
It's helping in a couple of ways. So if you take a look at a few studies, anytime that there's a collection of data and we can glean some knowledge from that, it's an opportunity for artificial intelligence. So just a few studies to take a look at. Researchers had collected data from 1,600 people, patients in the United States and UK, who had tested positive for COVID-19. And then they tracked their symptoms over a two-month period. And then after that, they were able to cluster the six symptoms into categories and then help identify whether some of those individuals who then, after they had collected that data, were going to be susceptible to more serious injury, so or more serious sickness. So there's an opportunity to, identify trends and patterns in the data and then identify if individuals are going to get more or less sick depending on the symptoms that they have because they were clustered together. Researchers are also taking images of lungs and then being able to diagnose and treat COVID from that perspective. So anytime that there's data or images, artificial intelligence can help identify the severity and then potential treatments off that.
We're also seeing chatbots being used to triage for signs of COVID. First, can you explain what a chatbot is?
A chatbot is just a piece of software that either through voice or through chat is able to have conversations back and forth with an individual.
And it might just appear up out of nowhere on your computer screen, like, hey, do you need some help right now? Is that an example?
Yeah. So a lot of healthcare providers right now are, using that as a gateway before they connect you with a live human being. And, some of the times people, their questions and their concerns can be put into a specific category. So chatbots are a way to help streamline some of the service process.
There's been a wide variability in chatbot responses as they have been triaging for signs of COVID. Will that undermine the value of these automated symptom checkers? Where are we headed with those?
Yeah, I think we're at the infancy of some of these technologies, and some of them are probably not ready for prime time in terms of being able to diagnose all of these things. So as we gain more and more knowledge and more experience with that, I think it'll help. But it's not a perfect technology. Nothing is. So I think there's still some opportunities on that front.
You sort of touched on risk prediction algorithms being widely used right now during COVID-19 to kind of, isolate where and which communities there will be an outbreak. Are these going to become more common? And what do you see there in the area of risk prediction algorithms?
Yeah. So what's interesting is let's take a look at a different data set. So again, anytime that we can collect data and then we can run it through some of these algorithms, we can hopefully glean some knowledge off of that. And one of the interesting studies that I had seen is that after we had locked down and then we began to open our economy back up again, they looked at the spread of COVID and specifically the spread of COVID related to restaurant receipts. So if we know people's behaviors because they're going to a restaurant and then, they're using their credit card, and then we can trace, okay, if there was a surge in credit card receipts and then all of a sudden in that particular area where those receipts were, there was a surge in spread, we can deem some knowledge about, okay, enclosed areas are an opportunity for this basically to be spread. So there's going to be pockets of this research that's going to happen to help us identify what's a risky behavior, what's not a risky behavior, and then hopefully adjust and modify so that we can, reduce the spread of this virus.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Matthew Friedel, who is a lecturer at UW-Milwaukee. He co-founded the Disruptive Technologies Lab, and we're spending the hour on AI, how it's used in our world, and especially right now in the COVID-19 pandemic. Taking your questions about AI, where you see it in your life, and how you see it used. Might it make your job obsolete? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Matthew, there is that worry that robots can take over jobs, and especially in the area of manufacturing. Where are we at with AI replacing humans on factory lines and elsewhere?
There's going to be disruptions in the workforce, and there's going to be disruptions in the workforce on the manufacturing side. What I would suggest to you, and then I'll give you a very specific example of what's happening in advanced manufacturing right now, is that anytime that there's been technology, and more specifically automation, there has been a shift in the type of work that we have done. So when I do presentations on this topic, I have a picture of a telephone operator, and I have a picture of a person doing bowling pin setting. And those used to be jobs at one point, and then they were eliminated because of technology and automation. So we are moving towards work of higher economic value. And on the manufacturing floor, that's going to change. So I'll give you a very concrete example. Preferred Networks is a Japanese company that has developed a robot arm that has a camera and machine learning, and given a picture of the outcome of the manufacturing product through trial and error, can figure out its own solution. So we are going to see changes on the manufacturing floor to much higher level of output, but it requires also new jobs, people that are going to install those machines, people that are going to maintain those machines, people that are going to design those machines. So we have to identify that and hopefully change as these technologies evolve.
And certainly working with those robotic arms and knowing where you need a human and where you don't, those are big questions.
Absolutely.
When you look here in Wisconsin at our big insurance industry, you have examples of how AI is being used at American Family and Northwestern Mutual. What do you see there?
I think there's lots of opportunity. In fact, Northwestern Mutual is a very interesting example, and I'll put a little plug in. UWM and Marquette University has a partnership with it, the Northwestern Mutual Data Science Institute, specifically around not only AI, but also data science, and we're evaluating that. And Northwestern has changed itself. It used to be the quiet company, and now it's evolving to a technology company, because they have to identify the fact that if you don't evolve, you will potentially perish because you are not able to adapt to the new environment.
And so what are they doing?
Well, I think they're identifying the fact that they're, a paper company, and then there's lots of low-hanging fruit in terms of being able to shift to digital. And think about your own behavior. Your phone now, you can access so many things, and you want instantaneous connection to your data. And I think that's what they're working towards. So a digital environment where it's not hard paper copies of your insurance contracts. It's digital. It's in your hand. It's instantaneous. And then, they're using their customer information in order to provide better products and services behind the scenes.
So that's really streamlining the customer experience and to make the products more immediate, more accessible?
Yes, you said that much better than me. So, yes, that's right.
Can you help us understand, in terms of language, there's GPT-3 and in healthcare manufacturing, what is this language and recent breakthroughs there?
Yeah, what's interesting is that I think in a non-COVID, non-election year, this would probably get more press. But GPT-3 is a generative pre-training language model, and it's from a research facility out in San Francisco called OpenAI. And what it's doing is it's consuming, reading significant amounts of written text. And let me give you an example of that. So all the English Wikipedia pages, think about that, constitute only about 0.6% of all of its data. So it's consuming huge, huge amounts. And out of that, what it can do is the system can generate written content. It can be stories, it can be code, it can be legal jargon, it can be poems. And with no human interaction.
Wait, you said poems?
Poems, yes.
Okay.
So it's reading in significant amounts of text, and poems are part of that. And then given a couple sentences or a couple words, it can generate original content. And it's deemed at this point, and if you Google GPT-3 and Twitter, you're going to see lots of examples of this. It's almost as good as original content from human beings. So the concern being is that, okay, is this going to replace individuals' jobs in terms of writing? So prior to this, from UWM, I just signed up to potentially access a beta account for them. So there's lots of opportunity in there, and it can be anything from language translation to answering basic emails to medical diagnosis, and then even search capabilities.
UW-Milwaukee's Matthew Friedel co-founded the Disruptive Technology Laboratory. You can join in. Are you pursuing a job in computer programming to one day work creating AI? 800-642-1234. Back after this news update on the Ideas Network. We're spending the hour on artificial intelligence, AI, on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The former head of Google says the U.S. could fall behind China unless we boost our AI capabilities in national security. Eric Schmidt is chairman of the National Security Commission on Artificial Intelligence, and he spoke at a virtual event hosted by Brookings last week and reported on by the Wall Street Journal. He said the commission wants to accelerate the Defense Department's AI research and development, saying he can think of no higher priority for the nation once the pandemic is behind us. How do you want to see our military agencies use AI? What is the role of AI in foreign policy and military strategy? What connections do you see between Silicon Valley and the Pentagon? Join in 800-642-1234. Matthew Friedel is a senior lecturer at UW-Milwaukee. He co-founded the Disruptive Technologies Lab, and he stays with us. Let's take a call now. Owen is with us from Waiwega this morning. Hi, Owen.
Good morning, Kate. I hope you guys have a moment just for a little bit of humor here. So, I have something that's definitely pertinent also to add, but, dairy farmers, we've been using AI for over 70 years. We call it artificial insemination. So every time you say AI, I kind of chuckle, but because we use the same abbreviations. But anyway, I was just hit in a parking lot by a elderly person that was using the AI technology for backup sensing that was supposed to brake the vehicle before it had an impact. And it was a newer Pontiac. I think it was a 2017 Pontiac that hit me. And I had never got any follow-ups from any GM engineers or anyone that was involved with the AI technology she was using, because it did fail. And I think it failed because my newer, brand new vehicle had a very large headlight. So it's translucent. So I don't really think the sensors was able to, that's exactly where she hit me too. I don't think the sensor was able to indicate that there was a obstruction in the way. So we have to be really careful, especially as the guest has stated, launching this type of technology in its infancy and allowing people to
depend on it. And Owen, thank you. Matt, what about sensors on vehicles and how AI is in our cars?
Yeah, so a couple of thoughts on self-driving autonomous vehicles. I think we are a ways out. So level 5 is, fully autonomous vehicle. And there are some taxis in Singapore that are operating in that capacity right now. But I think a level 4, which would be fully autonomous, but a driver in the vehicle, is probably not going to be here until past 2025. So if you take a look at the system, and no system is perfect, but theoretically, if you have self-driving autonomous vehicles working in concert, they should be safer. Because if you look at the statistics, 95% of serious accidents are actually occurred by human error. So autonomous vehicles working in concert should be better for the drivers, the passengers, the bicyclists, the pedestrians. And there are quite a few, you know, deaths throughout the year. So I don't think the technology is ready for prime time. We have to take baby steps, and we need regulations in this area. But theoretically, if it works correctly in concert, it should be create for a safer environment. But there are always, you know, anomalies in the system. But I think we're still at least 5 years out domestically from having those, you know, on the road.
Well, self-driving cars aside, there is still a lot of technology in the vehicles that we're operating today, especially newer models that have everything from backup cameras to, you know, sensing when you should change lanes.
Yeah. So there's, you know, technology across the board in terms of, you know, just making the vehicles safer and easier to operate. You know, it's the automaker's ability to try and evolve and then hopefully have a better experience for their customers.
We have Gary from Iron River who sent us an email and wants to look at AI in the finance industry. What can AI use in the investment industry, and how can that affect an individual investor when analyzing and choosing individual stocks?
Again, anytime that there's a mass collection of data, there's an opportunity to gain some and extract some knowledge off of that. So if you can identify patterns or clusters and identify if companies have an opportunity to increase their revenue and increase their profits, it'll be an opportunity for investors to be able to you know, grow off of that. There are many, many fintech companies that are being started right now. And in fact, it is almost analogous to the birth of the web themselves. So I had seen research there are over 10,000 fintech companies. And what I would identify is the fact that it's going to be similar to when we had the dot-coms. And I don't think we're going to have as significant of a bust, but there will be winners and losers in that space. So there will be Amazon.com and then will be pets.com. But what it's going to equate for us as individuals is, you know, better products and services as these companies grow and evolve and provide features for us.
Well, let's look at AI in the Defense Department and how nations are developing artificial intelligence for military functions. Can you give us some examples of what this arena looks like?
First of all, I agree with Eric Schmidt. China is taking AI very, very seriously. And I would almost argue on some fronts they are ahead of where we are. And I think of the United States as a very innovative place. I think, again, any time that you can glean knowledge or information from a collection of data, there's an opportunity for AI. So there's probably multiple fronts where defense can basically do this, anywhere from infantry to strategies. So I think there's lots of opportunities on the front. But we also have to be cautious about how we implement those items in an ethical way.
Yeah, Defense Secretary Mark Esper said earlier this year that AI technology will change much about the battlefield of the future, but nothing will change America's steadfast commitment to responsible and lawful behavior. Explain, you know, what are the problems with military AI in terms of ethics and human rights?
Well, I mean, so if you're getting outcomes out of the data and the information that you have, they can be good and bad. The question is, what do you do with that information? And then, you know, how do you execute upon that? So what I hope is that we're using that for positive, you know, not for the negative. And I think there is an opportunity there, but it's going to require, again, not only people in those positions that understand the technology and how to implement it in, but also some thought leaders in those space in order to say whether, you know, this is ethical and whether this makes sense for us to be able to execute this endeavor.
Yeah, he said that the Pentagon pledges that its AI efforts will be responsible, equitable, traceable, reliable, and governable. What does that mean?
I think they're trying to be transparent. They're trying to be above board, which is good. And I think we need that. I think we absolutely need that. Because otherwise we've seen, know, the negative consequences of not having those situations basically occur.
Talking with Matthew Friedel, senior lecturer at UW-Milwaukee, teaching courses on artificial intelligence. And you can join in with your questions about AI, where you see it headed, where you see it in your life. Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. You are an investor with a group called Silicon Pastures, where you pool together with other investors to help tech startups. What is the prospects of angel investing here in Wisconsin?
I think it's very good. I mean, we have a collection of educated, smart, motivated, talented people. So we are evaluating businesses across the whole spectrum of different kind of technologies, you know, every day. So I see plenty of opportunity, and I'll give you an example, a dichotomy of what's happening in our economy right now. So Briggs & Stratton, a 100-year-old company, the first place that I worked at when I left college, at the time, you know, the internal combustion engine was an innovation, right? And they have just recently filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, which is unfortunate. I think they're still going to operate, but they're on some hard times because of lower cost products coming from China and also from electrical, which is now an innovation that's on that front. So that's one segment of the older economy. And then now if you take a look at a company like EnsoData, so it's an artificial intelligence sleep treatment company out of Madison. We were evaluating them as an investment. They just recently raised $9 million. Their round was oversubscribed, which is a fancy way to say that they had more angels and venture capitalists who wanted to give them money than they were willing to take in. So this is the future. These companies are going to take in money. They're going to grow. They're going to employ our base, and we need to support and embrace embrace this change in the economy.
Well, once they get started up, once they start growing, do they need to move to the coasts in order to find their workforce?
I don't think they do. So I'm a little biased in this case because my daily job is to help educate the future workforce. And you know, that's why I'm looking at these technologies and that's why I'm teaching in these technologies, because I don't want companies to leave. I want companies to come here. And I think we have some assets in terms of cost of living, in terms of quality of life, that are attractive for companies to want to come here and retain our talent. And on a daily basis, my passion is, you know, helping young people become the professionals that they're going to do and, you know, go into these jobs and go into these companies.
We have technology lecturer Matthew Friedel as our guide to AI and algorithms that affect our lives in different ways. What are some of the ethical concerns you have about artificial intelligence? Are you worried about algorithms, you know, perpetuating racial stereotypes and injustices? How do you want to use AI for good? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Matthew Friedel here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation now on artificial intelligence and machine learning technology, the breakthroughs, the unintended consequences. We have Matthew Friedel with us. He's a UW-Milwaukee lecturer on AI and stays with us. Well, Matthew, I'm still hung up on this idea that AI is going to replace my work as a writer and, you know, how it can even make poetry. How can AI possess, you know, creative expression, creativity? It's a robot.
I don't think it can. So let's look at it from a different perspective. And I think the value is going to be created when we have humans and machines working in concert together. What do I mean by that? So what are humans really good at? They're good at creativity. They're good at improvisation, dexterity, judgment, social and leadership ability. So we identify that's what humans are really good at. What are machines good at? They're good at speed, accuracy, predictive capability, and scalability. So when you combine those together, that's what the secret sauce is. So I'll give you an example. So Stitch Fix is a clothing company that you can order clothes through their application. And you go through and you can select clothes. And behind the scenes, their algorithms, much like a Netflix algorithm, they're looking at clothes that are going to be tailored towards you and individuals like you and your categories. But at the end of the day, you don't get your package of clothes until a stylist confirms what the algorithms are suggesting for you. So there's always going to be a need for humans. There's always going to be a need for that creativity and that craftsmanship and that personalization. So at this point in time, the machines are just helping in that process, but they're not taking those jobs away. And I know that GPT-3 can generate content. That doesn't mean that it's quality content. It doesn't mean that it's personalized. It doesn't mean that it's crafted. It doesn't mean that it's really, reaching its target audience. So I still think, there will be disruptions in the workforce, but humans are good at very specific things, and we're going to continue to do that. So I'm not too pessimistic about the future from AI and creativity in the labor workforce front.
What does the future hold for regulation and oversight governing AI, making sure what is being created is humane and ethical?
I think this is a challenge because right now what's governing AI is the companies themselves. And if you actually take a look at Google, they had an ethics board that was created and dissolved, and I think they had some personal issues related to that. So I think it's going to take a couple things in concert. It's going to take the companies internally regulating these projects and being above board about that. And then some critical evaluation from government agencies about how we implement some of these programs. And I would love to have a utopian society where we don't run into situations like Cambridge Analytica. But I'm fearful that we will have some circumstance like that. So we have to be steadfast. We have to be steadfast about requiring our companies that collect our data to be ethical, and then asking our government officials to, evaluate them and constantly be looking at it. Just like with the self-driving autonomous vehicle, there has to be regulation so that our safety protocols are in place.
And yet companies may not want those regulations. They don't want to be hemmed in. They want to be able to have their autonomy and how they use those data sets and how much data they can gather.
Yeah, so just recently, a lot of the tech companies have been hauled in front of Congress, taking a look at their practices, and there's been conversations, are they too big? Should they be broken up? And I guess the analogy I would make is that we want our cars to be safe, and we have seatbelts in our cars, and that was a regulation that was put in place. And if these tech companies have to be governed in some way, have the seatbelt equivalent of regulations for their AI and how they use our data, that has to be in place, because the alternative is, bad outcomes related to that.
What are those bad outcomes that you would see that would really be setbacks to AI?
I think the misuse of our data, from a marketing perspective. So some of the studies that I've been reading recently, which I think are kind of interesting and almost a little bit disturbing, is that, some financial companies are generating what are called, surveillance scores. And CoreLogic and TransUnion is peddling a score to landlords that can predict whether they'll pay their rent on time, whether they'll be able to absorb rent increases, whether they'll break leases. And on the surface, that sounds good. Companies are concerned from a financial perspective, but you don't also want to disenfranchise people.
Well, Matthew, and I'm so sorry, we have to leave it there. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kate.
Matthew Friedel is a senior lecturer at UW-Milwaukee, where he co-founded the Disruptive Technologies Lab, which focuses on artificial intelligence. Coronavirus has put a spotlight on doctors. Many risked their own health to care for COVID-19 patients. Some lost their lives. It is a grim reality of the job and hasn't stopped people from applying to medical school. But what the pandemic has done is make an already difficult career to pursue even harder. Shemaine Mills explains.
Long before they use a stethoscope or wear a white coat, prospective doctors have to get into medical school. The application process is long and complicated. Acceptance rates are generally low. Some students who want to be physicians are having second thoughts, not about the career itself, but the timing. The country remains in the grip of a pandemic, which earlier this year temporarily brought life to a near standstill. The deadly virus disrupted classes, volunteer work, and other key activities that could make a pre-med student stand out in a sea of applicants. That's what Dr. Joseph Kirchner heard when hosting an online forum for a couple thousand pre-med students across the country. Kirchner is dean of the Medical College of Wisconsin.
Heard concern in their voice, you know, heard a lot of worries, heard them express difficulties at this time with the pandemic.
So Kirchner followed up that virtual town hall with a written column directed at pre-med students.
I felt called to write back to tell them, look, we heard you, we understand that this has been hard, but here's all the reasons why you should persevere, here's all the reasons why this is a great step for you to pursue.
Kirchner acknowledged the COVID-19 pandemic is presenting pre-med students with challenges unlike any in medical history. Despite the hurdles, he says the medical college is seeing applications hold steady or possibly increasing. 21-year-old Juan Adrian Lozama knows these hurdles all too well. He intended to take the medical college admission test this spring, but that was at the height of the pandemic. And officials didn't want hundreds of students packed into the same room spreading germs. So testing was temporarily called off, throwing the plans of Lozama and thousands of others across the country out the window.
End of April. That's what I wanted to shoot for. Not only was it full, but the beginning dates for April were canceled. So, of course, anything that followed that was just all full. The earliest one I could take is in June.
2 days before taking the all-important test, Lozama's grandfather died from COVID-19. The Milwaukee native was devastated but determined. He tearfully recalled how his grandfather had encouraged his dream of someday becoming a doctor.
I need to do this for him because he believed in me in China. Pursue this career.
One of the reasons Lozama wants to work in medicine is to provide better care for patients of color. The current COVID-19 crisis has affected blacks and Latinos the most, and his grandfather's death brought those sad statistics home. Lozama expected to be excited or nervous for the big test needed to get into medical school, but the family tragedy made it difficult to concentrate on what he'd studied and planned for since high school.
The exam felt indifferent. It just felt all monotonous. It didn't have feeling at all. And so I was like, oh, I don't think I did that well.
Turns out he underestimated himself. Lozama says he scored in the 75th percentile. He's applied to 3 medical schools, including the Medical College of Wisconsin. Lozama's gotten a taste of what it might be like to work in medicine by volunteering at a free health clinic in Milwaukee and how he might be uniquely qualified to help.
Sometimes we get patients that can't communicate that well in English, right? So there was one that his native language was Spanish, right? And I was able to help in that because I was working there that time. When I was able to at least translate what they were saying to him, it seemed that he felt more at ease.
Making that kind of difference for patients is part of why Lozama won't let the obstacles of the pandemic get in the way of pursuing his dream. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And this is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.